North of the Teeth of Camor, there are three shit barges at the private docks. You know the ones. They haul all the dreck and excrement out of the city and take it north to the fields.
Of course, said Doña Vorchenza.
Raza's been having his fortune hidden on one of them, said Locke, in wooden chests sealed in layers of oilcloth for obvious reasons. After he slips out of Camor, his plan is to meet the barge up north and offload the treasure. It's all there, underneath those heaps of shit, begging your pardon.
That's ridiculous, said Doña Vorchenza.
I didn't say my answer was going to be pleasant, said Locke. Think about it. What's the last place anyone would want to look for a cache of coins?
Which barge?
I don't know, said Locke. I just know that it's one of the three. Vorchenza looked over at Reynard.
Well, said the captain, there are reasons the gods saw fit to invent the enlisted man.
Oh, shit, said Locke, swallowing a lump in his throat. Make this good, he thought. Make this very good. Doña Vorchenza, this isn't over.
What are you talking about?
Boats, barges, escape. I've been thinking. The falconer made all sorts of strange jokes when he was under my knife. He was taunting me with something. I didn't have a chance to figure it out until now. That plague ship, the Satisfaction. You have to sink it.
And why would that be?
It belongs to Anatolius, said Locke. According to the falconer, Anatolius was a pirate on the White Iron Sea, building up his fortune so he could hire a bondsmage and return to Camor for his revenge. The Satisfaction is his ship, but Anatolius isn't planning to escape on it. He's leaving the city to the north, going up the Angevine.
Meaning what?
The falconer was dropping hints about a backup plan, said Locke. That plague ship is the backup plan. It's not full of corpses, Doña Vorchenza. It has a token crew, men who've survived exposure to Black Whisper like the Duke's ghouls. A token crew and holds full of animals, goats, sheep, donkeys. I thought the falconer was just trying to be irreverent, but think about it.
Animals can carry the whisper, said Reynard.
Yes, said Locke. It doesn't kill them, but they can sure as hell give it to us. Sink that fucking ship, Doña Vorchenza. It's Raza's other stroke. If he finds out he failed to wipe out the piers, he may attempt to take his revenge on the entire city. His last chance.
Madness,
Doña Vorchenza whispered, but she looked half convinced. Anatolius already tried to wipe out every last pier of Camor, down to the children. He is mad, Countess Amberglass. How well do you think he'll react to frustration? All his men have to do is beach that ship against the quay and let those animals out. If they get underway, you might not be able to stop them in time. Or maybe they'll just toss a few sheep into the city with a catapult. Sink that fucking ship!
Master Thorne, said Doña Vorchenza, you have a curiously tender heart for a thief of your appetites.
I'm a sworn brother of the Nameless 13th, the Crooked Warden, the Benefactor, said Locke. I'm a priest. I didn't save the people in this tower just to see my entire city die. For propriety's sake, Doña Vorchenza, for propriety's sake, sink that god's damned ship, I beg you. She stared at him over the edges of her half-moon optics, then turned to Reynard.
Captain, she said slowly, go to the lantern station on the embarkation platform. Flash messages to the arsenal and the dregs.
She folded her hands over her stomach and sighed.
On my authority, in the name of Duke Nicovante, sink the Satisfaction and shoot down any survivor who tries to reach shore.
Locke sighed with relief. Thank you, Doña Vorchenza. Now, my elevator?
Your elevator, Master Thorne.
She actually ground her teeth together for a second.
As promised, I'll have one made ready for you without delay. If the gods should give you Caparaza before my men find him, may they give you strength.
I'm going to miss you, Doña Vorchenza, said Locke. And you as well, my lord and lady Salvara. All apologies for getting most of your fortune buried under shit. I hope we can still be friends. "Set foot in our house again," said Sophia, "and you'll become a permanent fixture in my laboratory." 7. Blue light flashed from the embarkation platform of Raven's Reach. Even against the shifting glimmer of false light, it stood out well enough to be seen at the relay station atop the Palace of Patience. In moments, shutters were falling rapidly open and closed over signal lanterns. The message passed through the air over the heads of thousands of revelers and arrived at its destinations, the Arsenal, the South Needle, the Dregs.
"Holy Mother of Shit!"
said the watch sergeant in the tower at the very tip of the South Needle, blinking to clear his eyes, wondering if he'd counted the signal flashes right. He slipped his illicit Day of Changes wineskin beneath his chair with pangs of guilt.
"Watch sergeant," said his younger companion, "that ship's up to something awful funny."
Out on the water of Old Harbour, the Satisfaction was slowly turning to larboard. Sailors could just barely be seen atop the yards of the main and foremasts, preparing to unfurl topsails. Dozens of small dark shapes were moving on deck, doubly lit by the glow of yellow lamps and the glare of false light.
"She's casting, sir. She's going to make for sea. Where'd all those people come from?" said the younger watchman.
"I don't know," said the sergeant, "but the signal's just gone up. Merciful gods, they're going to sink that yellow-lit bitch."
Pinpoints of bright orange light began to erupt around the periphery of the dregs. Each little engine tower had emergency oil lamps that served to signal when they were both manned and ready for action. Drums beat within the arsenal and whistles sounded from across the city above the low echoing murmur of the Day of Changes crowds. One of the engines on the dreg's shore loosed with an echoing crash. The stone was a blurred shadow in the air. It missed by yards and raised a white fountain on the frigate's starboard side. The next engine to let fly hurled an arc of orange-white fire that seemed to hang in the sky, a hypnotic banner of burning light. The South Needle watchman stared in awe as it crashed down onto the Satisfaction's deck, spraying hot tendrils in every direction. Men ran frantically about on the deck, some of them obviously on fire. One leapt from the vessel's side, plunging into the water like a burning cinder thrown into a puddle.
"Gods, that's fire oil!" said the younger watchman. "It won't stop burning even down there."
"Well, even sharks like cooked meat," said the sergeant with a chuckle. "Poor bastards."
A stone crashed against the side of the frigate, shattering wooden rails and sending splinters flying. Men whirled and screamed and fell to the deck. The fire was rising into the sails and rigging, despite the frantic efforts of the Satisfaction's crew to control it with sand. Another fire barrel exploded against the quarterdeck. The men and women at the wheel were engulfed in a roaring nimbus of white flame. They didn't even have time to scream. Stones battered the ship and tore through her few fluttering sails. Fires burned out of control at her bow, her stern, and amidships. Fingers of orange and red and white capered about the decks and rose into the sky, along with smoke in several colors. Under the arc of a dozen throwing engines, the unarmed and nearly motionless frigate never had a chance. 5 minutes after the signal had flashed forth from Raven's Reach, the Satisfaction was a pyre, a mountain of red and white flame reaching up from the water that rippled like a red mirror beneath the dying ship's hull. Archers took up position on the shore, ready to shoot down any survivors who tried to swim for it, but there were none. Between the fire and the water and the things that lurked in the harbor's depths, arrows were unnecessary. 8. Luciano Anatolius, the Grey King, the Cupper of Camor, the last living member of his family line, stood alone on the upper deck of the floating grave, beneath the silk awnings that fluttered in the hangman's wind, beneath the dark sky that reflected the eerie waver of false light, and watched his ship burn. He stared into the west with the red fire rippling in his eyes, and he did not blink. He stared north to the glowing tower of Raven's Reach, where flashing blue and red lights could be seen, where no cloud of pale white smoke was rising against the sky. He stood alone on the deck of the floating grave, and he did not cry, though in his heart he desired nothing more at that moment. Shirin and Raiza would not have cried. Mother and father would not have cried. They had not cried when Barsavi's men had kicked in their door in the middle of the night, when his father had died trying to defend them all long enough for Gisella to bundle him and the little twins out the back door. The satisfaction burned before his eyes, but in his mind he was running through the darkness of the gardens once again, 13 years old, stumbling over familiar paths with branches lashing his face and hot tears streaming down his cheeks. In the villa behind them, knives were rising and falling. A small child was crying for her mother, and then that crying suddenly stopped.
"We'll never forget,"
Raiza had said, in the dark hold of the ship that had carried them to Talisham.
"We'll never forget, will we, Luciano?"
Her little hand had curled tight inside his. Sherin slept uneasily against his other side, murmuring and crying out in her sleep.
"We'll never forget," he'd replied, "and we'll go back. I promise you, some day we'll go back."
He stood on the deck of Barsavi's fortress in Camor, and he had the power to do exactly nothing as his ship turned the waters of Old Harbor blood-red with its death.
"Caparaza?"
There was a hesitant voice behind him. A man came up through the passage from the galleries below, one of the rum-hounds from the extravagant gambling circle that had grown in his throne room. He turned slowly.
"Caparaza, this just got brought in. One of the false-light cutters, Your Honor. Says a man in Ashfall gave him a tyrin and told him to get this to you right away."
The man held out a burlap sack. Raza was scrawled on it in rough black letters. The ink still seemed to be wet. Luciano took the bag and waved the man away. The rumhound ran for the passage and vanished down it, not at all pleased with what he'd seen in his master's eyes. The copper of Camor opened the bag and found himself staring down at the body of a scorpion hawk, a headless scorpion hawk. He turned the bag upside down and let the contents fall to the deck. The head and the body of Vestris bounced against the wooden planks. A folded, blood-stained piece of parchment fluttered down after them. He grabbed at it and opened it. "We're coming." Luciano stared down at the note for an unknown interval of time. It might have been 5 seconds, it might have been 5 minutes. Then he crumpled it in his hands and let it fall. It hit the deck and rolled to a rest beside Vestris' glassy, staring eyes. If they were coming, they were coming. There would be time enough for escape when this last personal debt was discharged. He went down the passage to the gallery below, into the light and the noise of the ongoing party. The smell of smoke and liquor hung in the air. His booted feet made the boards creak as he hurried down the stairs. Men and women looked up from their cards and dice as he stalked past. Some waved and shouted greetings or honorifics. None of them received any response. Caparaza threw open the door to his private suite of apartments, formerly Barsavi's, and vanished inside for several minutes. When he emerged, he was dressed as the Grey King, in his old fog-grey leather vest and breeches, in his grey shark-skin boots with the tarnished silver buckles, in his grey swordsman's gloves creased at the knuckles from use, in his grey cloak and mantle with the hood raised. His cloak fluttered behind him as he moved forward. The lights of the floating grave gleamed on the naked steel of his drawn rapier. The party died in an instant.
"Get out," he said. "Get out and stay away. Leave the doors open. No guards. Get out while I'll still give you the chance."
Cards spiraled down to the deck. Dice rattled across the wood. Men and women jumped to their feet, dragging drunk comrades with them. Bottles rolled and wine pooled as the general retreat progressed. In less than a minute, the Grey King stood alone at the heart of the floating grave. He strolled slowly over to a bank of silver cords that hung down from the ceiling on the starboard side of the old galleon. He pulled on one, and the white lights of the chandeliers died. He pulled another, and the curtains over the room's tall windows were pulled back, opening the throne room to the night. A tug on a third cord, and red alchemical globes came to life in dark niches on the walls. The heart of the wooden fortress became a cave of carmine light. He sat upon his throne with the rapier balanced across his legs, and the red light made fires of his eyes within the shadowed hood. He sat upon his throne and waited for the last two gentlemen bastards to find him. 9. At 10:30 the tenth hour of the evening, Loch-Lamora entered that throne room and stood with one hand on his rapier, staring at the Grey King, seated 30 yards away in his silent audience chamber. Loch was breathing hard, and not merely from his journey south. He'd covered most of the distance on a stolen horse. The feel of the hilt of Reynard's blade beneath his hand was at once exhilarating and terrifying. He knew he was probably at a disadvantage in a straightforward fight, but his blood was up. He dared to imagine that anger and speed and hope could sustain him for what was coming. He cleared his throat.
"Grey King," he said, "Thorn of Camor."
"I'm pleased," said Locke. "I thought you might have left already, but I'm sorry. You needed that frigate, didn't you? I had my good friend, the Countess Amberglass, send it to the bottom of the fucking bay."
"That deed," said the Grey King in a weary voice, "will lose its savour in a few minutes, I assure you. Where's Jean Tannen?"
"On his way," said Locke. "On his way." Locke walked forward slowly, cutting the distance between them in half.
"I warned the falconer not to toy with Tannen," said the Grey King. "Apparently my warning wasn't heeded. I congratulate you both for your improbable resilience, but now I fear I'll be doing you a favour by killing you before the Bonds Magi can take their revenge."
"You're assuming the falconer is dead," said Locke. "He's still breathing, but he'll, never play any musical instruments again."
"Interesting. How have you done all this, I wonder? Why does the Death Goddess scorn to snuff you like a candle? I wish I knew."
"Fuck your wishes. Why did you do it the way you did, Luciano? Why didn't you try for an honest accommodation with us? One might have been reached."
"Might," said the Grey King. "There was no room for might, Lamora. There were only my needs. You had what I needed, and you were too dangerous to let live once I had it. You've made that only too clear."
"But you could have settled for simple theft," said Locke. "I would have given it all to keep Carlo and Galdo and Bug alive. I would have given it all, had you put it to me like that."
"What thief does not fight to hold what he has?"
"One that has something better," said Locke. "The stealing was more the point for us than the keeping. If the keeping had been so fine, we would have found something to fucking do with it all."
"Easy to say in hindsight," the Grey King sighed. "You would have said something different when they were still alive."
"We stole from the peers, you asshole. We stole from them exclusively. Of all the people to double-cross, you aided the nobility when you tried to wipe us out. You gave the people you hate a God's damned gift."
"So you relieved them of their money, Master Lamora, scrupulously refraining from taking lives in the process. Should I applaud? Name you a brother in arms? There's always more money, Lamora. Theft alone would not teach them the lesson they had coming."
"How could you do it, Luciano? How could a man who lost what you lost, who felt what you felt for Barsavi, do the same to me?"
"The same?"
The Grey King leapt up. The rapier was in his hand.
"The same? Were your parents murdered in their beds to protect a lie, Master Lamora? Were your infant siblings put to the knife so they could never grow old enough to revenge? Thief! You don't know what crime truly is."
"I lost 3 brothers at your hands," said Locke. "I almost lost 4. You didn't need to do it. When you thought you were finished with me, you tried to kill hundreds. Children, Luciano, children, born years after Barsavi murdered your parents. It must be nice to be righteous. From where I'm standing, it looks like fucking lunacy.
They were sheltered by the secret peace, said the Grey King. They were parasites, guilty by birth. Save your arguments, priest. Don't you think I've had them with myself on too many nights to count over the past 22 fucking years?
The Grey King took a step forward, the tip of his blade rising in Locke's direction.
If it were in my power, he said, I would knock this city to the ground and write the names of my family in its ashes.
Illa justica vecala,
Locke whispered. He stepped forward once again, until they were separated by barely 2 yards. He slid Reynard's rapier out of its scabbard and stood at guard.
Justice is red.
The Grey King faced Locke with his knees bent, the true edge of his rapier facing the ground, in the position Camorri fencers called the waiting wolf.
It is indeed.
Locke struck out before the Grey King had finished speaking. For an eye-blink, darting steel cut an after-image in the air between the two men. The Grey King parried Locke's thrust, fought to foible, and riposted with speed more than equal to Locke's own. Lamora avoided a skewering only by an undignified backward lunge. He landed in a crouch with his left hand splayed out to keep himself from going ass over elbows on the hard wood of the deck. Warily, Locke circled in the direction the lunge had knocked him, barely rising from his crouch. A dagger appeared in his left hand as though by leisure de main. This he twirled several times.
Said the Grey King. Tell me you don't mean to fight Verari style. I find the school insipid.
Please yourself. Locke wiggled his dagger suggestively. I'll try not to get too much blood on your cloak. Sighing theatrically, the Grey King plucked one of 2 narrow-hilted daggers from his own belt and held it out so that his blades opened in the air before him like jaws. He then took 2 exaggerated hops forward. Locke flicked his gaze down to the Grey King's feet for a fraction of a second, realizing almost too late that he was intended to do just that. He whipped himself to his right and barely managed a parry with his dagger. The Grey King's thrust slid off and cut the air just an inch from his left shoulder. His own riposte met the Grey King's dagger as though intended for it. Again, Anatolius was too fast by half. For a few desperate seconds, the 2 men were fully engaged. Their blades wove silver ghosts in the air, crossing and uncrossing, faint and false faint, thrust and parry. Locke remained just out of reach of the Grey King's longer, more muscular cuts, while the Grey King caught and turned Locke's every lunge with easy precision. At last they flew apart and stood panting, staring at one another with the resigned, implacable hatred of fighting dogs.
Said the Grey King. An illuminating passage.
He flicked out almost casually with his rapier. Locke darted back once again and parried feebly, tip to tip, like a boy in his first week of training. The Grey King's eyes glittered.
Most illuminating.
Again a casual flick. Again Locke jumped back.
You're not actually very good at this, are you?
It would be to my advantage if you thought so, wouldn't it? At this the Grey King actually laughed.
Oh, no, 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 no.
With 1 decisive gesture he flung his cloak and mantle to the ground. A wild grin had etched deep furrows of anticipation into his lean face.
No more bluffs, no more games.
And then he fell on Locke, his footwork a blur, his brutality unmatched by anything in Locke's memory. Behind his blade there were 20 years of experience and 20 years of blackest hatred. Some tiny detached part of Locke's mind coolly registered his own inadequacy as he desperately flailed parry after parry, chasing phantom thrusts with his eyes and hands, even while the Grey King's steel was punching through cloth and flesh. Once, twice, 3 times... In between breaths, the Grey King's blade sang out and bit Locke's left wrist, forearm, and biceps. Cold surprise hit Locke harder than the pain of the thrusts. Then the warm blood began to flow across his sweat-slick skin, tickling devilishly, and a wave of nausea rose up from the pit of his stomach. The dagger dropped from his left hand, red with the wrong man's blood.
"At last we come to something you cannot pretend your way out of, Master Lamora."
The Grey King flicked Locke's blood from the tip of his rapier and watched it splash against the wooden deck in an arc.
"Goodbye."
Then he was moving again, and in the wine-coloured light of the alchemical globes the full length of his blade was bright scarlet.
"Azaguia," Locke whispered, "give me justice for the death of my friends. Give me blood for the death of my brothers."
His voice rising to a shout, he thrust, missed, and thrust again, willing all of his desperate hatred and fear into each cut, driving the blade faster than he ever had in his life, and still the Grey King caught and turned his every thrust. Still the Grey King displaced himself from the path of Locke's cuts as though fighting a child.
"It seems that the final difference between us, Master Lamora," said the Grey King between passages, "is that I knew what I was doing when I stayed here to meet you one last time."
"No," gasped Locke. "The difference between us is that I'm going to have my revenge." Cold pain exploded in Locke's left shoulder, and he stared down in horror at the Grey King's blade, sunk 3 inches into his flesh just above his heart. The Grey King twisted savagely, scraping bone as he withdrew his rapier, and the sensation sent Locke tumbling to his knees, his useless left arm thrown out instinctively to break his fall. But instinct, too, betrayed him here. His hand struck the hard deck palm up, folded awkwardly under the full weight of his arm, and with a terrible sharp snap his left wrist broke. He was too shocked to scream. A split second later the Grey King slammed a vicious kick into the side of Locke's head, and Locke's world became a kaleidoscope of agony, tumbling end over end as stinging tears filled his eyes. Reynard's rapier clattered across the deck. Locke was conscious of the wood pressing up against his back. He was conscious of the blood that misted his vision. He was conscious of the bright, hot rings of pain that radiated from his shattered wrist, and of the slick, wet agony of the hole in his shoulder joint. But most of all, he was conscious of his own shame, his own terror of failure, and the great weight of 3 dead friends lying unavenged, lying unquiet because Locke Lamora had lost. He sucked in a great gasping breath, kindling new flickers of pain all across his chest and back. But now it was all one pain, all one red sensation that drove him up from the ground. Bellowing without an ounce of reason in his voice, he pulled his legs in and whipped himself up, attempting to tackle the Grey King around the stomach. The killing thrust that had been falling toward Locke's heart struck his left arm instead. Impelled with every ounce of the Grey King's ferocity, it punched fully through the meat of Locke's slender forearm and out the other side. Wild with pain, Locke threw his arm forward and up as the Grey King struggled to withdraw. The edges of his rapier worked a terrible business on Locke's flesh, but stayed caught, sawing back and forth at the muscle as the two men struggled. The Grey King's dagger loomed before Locke's eyes. Some animal instinct drove Locke to lash out with the only weapon available. His teeth sank into the first 3 fingers of the Grey King's hand where they wrapped around the hilt. He tasted blood and felt bone beneath the tips of his teeth. The Grey King cried out and the dagger fell sideways, rebounding off Locke's left shoulder before clattering to the deck. The Grey King jerked his hand free and Locke spat the man's skin and blood back at him.
"Give it up!"
the Grey King screamed, punching Locke atop his skull, then across his nose. With his good right arm, Locke clutched for the Grey King's sheathed dagger. The Grey King slapped his hand away, laughing.
"You can't win! You can't win, Lamora!"
With every exhortation, the Grey King rained blows on Locke, who clutched at him desperately as a drowning man might hug a floating timber. The Grey King laughed savagely as he pummeled Lamora's skull, his ears, his forehead, and his shoulders, deliberately driving his fist down into the seeping wound.
"You cannot beat me!"
"I don't have to beat you,"
Locke whispered, grinning madly up at the Grey King, his face streaked with blood and tears, his nose broken and his lips cracked, his vision swimming and edged with blackness.
"I don't have to beat you, motherfucker. I just have to keep you here until Jean shows up."
At that, the Grey King became truly desperate, and his blows fell like rain, but Locke was heedless of them, laughing the wet braying laugh of utter madness.
"I just have to keep you here until Jean shows up."
Hissing fury, the Grey King shook Locke's grip off enough to make a grab for his sheathed dagger. As he tore his left hand from Locke's right, Lamora let a gold Tarin coin fall from his sleeve into his palm. A desperate flick of his wrist sent the coin caroming off the wall behind the Grey King, echoing loudly.
"There he is, motherfucker!"
Locke yelled, spraying blood across the front of the Grey King's shirt.
"Jean, help me!"
And the Grey King whirled, dragging Locke halfway around with him, whirled in fear of Jean Tannen before he realized that Locke must be lying, whirled for just the half-second that Locke would have begged from any god that would hear his prayer, whirled for the half-second that was worth Locke's entire life. He whirled just long enough for Locke Lamora to snake his right arm around the Grey King's waist and slide out the dagger sheathed there and bury it with a final scream of pain and triumph in the Grey King's back, just to the right of his spine. The Grey King's back arched, and his mouth hung open, gasping in the icy thrall of shock. With both of his arms he pushed at Locke's head, as though by prying the smaller man off he could undo his wound. But Locke held fast, and in an impossibly calm voice he whispered,
"Carlo Sansa, my brother and my friend."
Backward the Grey King toppled, and Locke slid the knife out of his back just before he struck the deck. Locke fell on top of him. He raised the dagger once again and brought it down in the middle of the Grey King's chest, just beneath his ribcage. Blood spurted and the Grey King flailed, moaning. Locke's voice rose as he worked the knife farther in.
"Galdo Sansa, my brother and my friend!"
With one last convulsive effort, the Grey King spat warm, coppery blood into Locke's face and grabbed at the dagger that transfixed his chest. Locke countered by bearing down with his useless left side, batting the Grey King's hands away. Sobbing, Locke wrenched the dagger out of the Grey King's chest, raised it with a wildly shaking right arm, and brought it down in the middle of the Grey King's neck. He sawed at the windpipe until the neck was half severed and great rivers of blood were flowing on the deck. The Grey King shuddered one last time and died, his wide white eyes still fixed on Locke's.
"Bark," Locke whispered. "His real name was Bertillion Gadec. My apprentice, my brother, and my friend."
His strength failed, and he slid down atop the Grey King's corpse.
"My friend."
But the man beneath him said nothing, and Locke was acutely aware of the stillness of the chest beneath his ears, of the heart that should have been beating against his cheek, and he began to cry, long, wild sobs that racked his entire body, drawing new threads of agony from his tortured nerves and muscles. Mad with grief and triumph and the red haze of pain and 100 other feelings he couldn't name, he lay atop the corpse of his greatest enemy and bawled like a baby, adding salt water to the warm blood that covered the body of the Grey King. He lay there shaking in the light of the red lamps, in a silent hall, alone with his triumph, unable to move and bleeding to death. 10. Jean found him there just a minute or two later. The big man turned Locke over and slid him off the Grey King's corpse, eliciting a sincere howl of pain from his half-conscious friend.
"Oh, gods!" Jean cried. "Oh, gods, you fucking idiot! You miserable fucking bastard!"
He pressed his hands against Locke's chest and neck, as though he could simply will the blood back into his body.
"Why couldn't you wait? Why couldn't you wait for me?"
Locke stared drunkenly up at Jean, his mouth a little O of concern.
"Jean," Locke whispered gravely, "you have been running. You were in no condition to fight. Grey King, so accommodating, could not refuse."
Jean snorted despite himself. "Gods damn you, Locke Lamora. I sent him a message. I thought it might keep him around a while."
"Bless your heart. I did get him, though. I got him, and I burnt his ship."
"So that's what happened," Jean said very gently. "I saw. I was watching the fire from the other side of the wooden waste. I saw you walk into the floating grave like you owned the place, and I came running as fast as I could, but you didn't even need me."
"Oh, no,"
Locke swallowed, grimacing at the taste of his own blood.
"I made excellent use of your reputation."
At this Jean said nothing, and the forlorn light of his eyes chilled Locke more than anything yet.
"So this is revenge," Locke mumbled.
"It is," whispered Jean. After a few seconds, new tears welled up in Locke's eyes, and he closed them, shaking his head.
"It's a shit business."
"It is."
"You have to leave me here."
At this, Jean rocked back on his knees as though he'd been slapped.
"Leave me, Jean. I'll be dead. Just a few minutes. They won't get anything from me. You can still get away. Please, leave me."
Jean's face turned bright red, a red that showed even by the light of the alchemical globes, and his eyebrows arched, and every line in his face drew so taut that Locke found the energy to be alarmed. Jean's jaw clenched, his teeth ground together, and the planes of his cheeks stood out like mountain ridges under his gilding of fat.
"That is a hell of a thing for you to say to me,"
he finally hissed in the flattest, deadliest voice Locke had ever heard.
"I made a mistake, Jean," Locke croaked in desperation. "I couldn't really fight him. He did for me before I could cheat my way out of it. Just promise me that if you ever find Sabatha, you'll..."
"You can find her yourself, half-wit, after we both get the hell out of here."
"Jean!"
Locke clutched weakly at the lapels of Jean's coat with his good hand.
"I'm sorry, I fucked up. Please don't stay here and get caught. The Black Jackets will be coming soon. I couldn't bear to have you taken. Please just leave me. I can't walk."
"Idiot,"
Jean whispered, brushing away hot tears with his good hand.
"You won't have to."
Working awkwardly but rapidly, Jean took up the Grey King's cloak and tied it around his own neck, creating a makeshift sling for his right arm. This he slid beneath Locke's knees, and straining mightily, he was able to pick the smaller man up and cradle him in front of his chest. Locke moaned.
"Quit sobbing, you damn baby,"
Jean hissed as he began to lope back along the dock.
"You must have at least a half-beer glass of blood left somewhere in there."
But Locke was now well and truly unconscious. Whether from pain or blood loss, Jean couldn't tell, and his skin was so pale that it almost looked like glass. His eyes were open but unseeing, and his mouth hung open, trailing blood and spittle. Panting and shuddering, ignoring the wrenching pains of his own wounds, Jean turned and began to run as fast as he could. The body of the Grey King lay forgotten on the deck behind him, and the red light shone on in the empty hall. Interlude. A Minor Prophecy. Father Chains sat on the roof of the House of Perelandro, staring down at the astonishingly arrogant 14-year-old that had grown out of the little orphan he'd purchased so many years before from the thief-maker of Shades Hill.
"Some day, Locke Lamora," he said, "some day you're going to fuck up so magnificently, so ambitiously, so overwhelmingly that the sky will light up, and the moons will spin, and the gods themselves will shit comets with glee. And I just hope I'm still around to see it."
"Oh, please," said Locke,
It'll never happen.
Epilogue. False Light. 1. The 18th of Parthis, in the 78th year of Azaguia, wet Camori summer, the whole city had a hangover, and the sky did, too. Warm rain was falling in sheets, spattering and steaming in the glow of false light. The water caught the false light glimmer like layers of shifting, translucent mirrors, and formed split-second works of art in the air. But men cursed it anyway, because it made their heads wet.
"Watch, Sergeant! Watch, Sergeant Vidric!"
The man yelling outside Vidric's station at the south end of the Narrows was another watchman. Vidric stuck his lean, weathered face out through the window beside the shack's door and was rewarded with a stream of runoff on his forehead. Thunder boomed overhead.
"What is it, son?"
The watchman approached out of the rain. It was Constanzo, the new lad just shifted in from the north corner. He was leading a gentled donkey. Behind the donkey was an open-topped cart, with two more yellow-jacketed watchmen at its rear. They huddled in their oil cloaks and looked miserable, which meant they were sensible men.
"Found something, Sergeant," said Costanzo. "Something pretty fucked."
Teams of yellow-jackets and black-jackets had been combing the south of Camor since the previous night. Rumours were swirling of some sort of assassination attempt at Raven's Reach. Gods only knew what the spider thought his boys should be doing, turning over stones in the dregs and the ashfall districts, but Vidric was used to never hearing the whys and the wherefores.
"Define pretty fucked,"
he yelled as he slipped into his own oil cloak and threw up the hood. He stepped out into the rain and crossed to the donkey cart, waving to the two men standing behind it. One of them owed him 2 barons from the previous week's dicing.
"Have a look,"
said Constanzo, sweeping back the wet blanket that covered the donkey cart's cargo. Beneath it was a man, youngish and very pale, balding with a fuzz of stubble on his cheeks. He was fairly well dressed, in a grey coat with red cuffs. It happened to be spattered with blood. The man was alive, but he lay in the cart with his fingerless hands pressed against his cheeks, and he stared up at Vidric without a speck of sane comprehension in his eyes.
"Nah,"
he moaned as the rain fell on his head.
"Mwah!"
His tongue had been cut out. A dark scar covered the stump at the bottom of his mouth, oozing blood.
"Mwah!"
"Sweet fucking Paralandro," said Vidric. "Tell me I don't see what I see on his wrists."
"It's a bondsmage, Sergeant," said Constanzo. "It is... or it was."
He threw the soaked blanket back over the man's face and reached inside his oil cloak.
"There's more. Show it to you inside."
Vidric led Constanzo back into his shack. The two men swept their hoods back but didn't bother taking their cloaks off. Constanzo pulled out a piece of folded parchment.
"We found this fellow tied to a floor over in Ashfall," he said. "Pretty goddamned weird. This parchment was on his chest."
Vidric took it and unfolded it to read, "Personal attention of the Duke's spider for return to Carthane."
"Gods," he said, "a real Carthani bondsmage. Looks like he won't be recommending Camor to his friends."
"What do we do with him, Sergeant?"
Vidric sighed, folded the letter, and passed it back to Constanzo.
"We pass the coin, lad," he said. "We pass this fucking coin right up the chain of command, and we forget we ever saw it. Haul him to the Palace of Patience and let someone else give it a ponder."
2. False light glimmered on the rain-rippled water of Camor Bay as Doña Angiovesta Vorcenza, Dowager Countess of Amberglass, stood on the dock, huddled in a fur-lined oil-cloak, while teams of men with wooden poles prowled through a barge full of rain-sodden shit beneath her. The smell was attention-grabbing.
"I'm sorry, my lady," said the watch sergeant at her left hand. "We're positive there's nothing on the other 2 barges, and we've been at this one for 6 hours. I sincerely doubt that anything will turn up. We will, of course, continue our efforts."
Doña Vorcenza sighed deeply and turned to look at the carriage that stood on the dock behind her, drawn by four black stallions and framed with alchemical running lights in the Vorcenza colours. The door was open. Don and Doña Salvara sat inside, peering out at her, along with Captain Reynard. She beckoned to them. Reynard was the first to reach her side. As usual, he wore no oil cloak, and he bore the heavy rain with stiff-necked stoicism. The Salvaras were sensibly covered up against the downpour. Lorenzo held up a silk parasol to shield his wife even further.
"Let me guess," said Reynard. "They're full of shit."
"I'm afraid so," said Doña Vorcenza. "Thank you for your time, Watch Sergeant. You are dismissed. You may call your men out of the barge as well. I don't believe we'll be needing them any more."
As the greatly relieved yellow jackets filed away down the dock, wooden poles held very carefully on their shoulders, Doña Vorcenza seemed to shudder and gasp. She put her hands to her face and bent forward.
"Doña Vorcenza!"
cried Sophia, rushing forward to grab her by the shoulders. As they all bent close around her, she suddenly straightened up and cackled, gasping in air between bursts of dry-sounding laughter. She shook with it. Her tiny fists punched the air before her.
"Oh, gods!" she gasped. "This is too much!"
"What? Doña Vorcenza, what's the matter?"
Reynard grabbed her by the arm and peered at her.
"The money, Stephen," she chuckled. "The money was never anywhere near this place. The little bastard had us digging through shit barges purely for his own amusement. The money was on board the Satisfaction."
"How do you figure that?"
"Isn't it plain? It's all striking me from so many directions at once. Caparaza assisted with the charitable contributions to the plague ship, yes?"
"He did."
"Not from any sense of charitable duty, but because he needed a means to move his fortune out to the frigate."
"Out to the plague ship?" said Doña Sophia. "That wouldn't do him any good."
"It would if there was no plague," said Doña Vorcenza. "The plague was a lie."
"But," said Don Lorenzo, "why was Lucas so adamant about sinking that ship? Was it simple pique? If he couldn't have it, no one could?"
"His name was Callas, Lorenzo dear, Tavrin Callas."
"Whichever, darling," said Lorenzo. 45,000 crowns, plus whatever Barsavi's fortune came to, that's a great deal of money to put out of everyone's grasp forever."
"Yes," said Doña Vorcenza, "and he told us why he was doing it while he stood there. Damn me for a fool."
"I fear," said Doña Sophia, "I speak for the rest of us when I say we don't follow."
"The Thorn said he was a priest of the 13th. She said. "The heresy of the Nameless 13th, the Crooked Warden, the God of Thieves and Malefactors. For propriety's sake," he said. "For propriety's sake." He said that on purpose.
She laughed again, biting down on her knuckles to contain herself.
"Oh, gods! Anatolius killed three of his friends. So don't you see? There was no danger on that ship. He didn't want it sunk to save Camor. It was a death offering, Stephen. A death offering."
Reynard slapped one hand against his forehead. Water flew.
"Yes," said Doña Vorcenza. "And I sank it for him in 60 fathoms of shark-infested water, neat as you please."
"So," said Don Lorenzo, "all of our money is 360 feet down on the bottom of Old Harbor?"
"I'm afraid so," said Doña Vorcenza.
"Ah, what do we do now?"
Doña Vorcenza sighed and meditated for a few moments.
"First," she said, when she looked back up at the Salvaras, "all the truths behind this affair will be declared state secrets of the Duchy of Camor. I bind you all to silence concerning them. The Thorn of Camor is a myth. The money he allegedly stole never existed. The Duke Spider never took any formal interest in the matter.
But, said Doña Sofia, they told Lorenzo that's how the Thorn guarantees his own secrecy, when they stole into our house dressed as Midnighters.
Yes, said her husband. One of the false Midnighters specifically told me that the Thorn relied on the embarrassment of his victims to keep his theft secret from other potential victims, and I don't think that part was a lie.
I'm sure it wasn't, said Doña Vorcenza. But nonetheless, that's just what we're going to do. In time you'll come to understand that a state like ours cannot afford to offer up a show of weakness for honesty's sake. Duke Nicovante charges me with vouchsafing his security, not his conscience.
The Salvaras stared at her, saying nothing.
Oh, don't look so glum, she said. Your real punishment for getting involved in this mess has not yet begun. Come back to Amberglass with me and let's talk about the penalty.
Our punishment, Doña Vorcenza? Said Lorenzo hotly. Our punishment was nearly 17,000 crowns. Haven't we been punished enough?
Not nearly, said Doña Vorcenza. I've decided who's to inherit the title of Countess Amberglass when it's my time to pass on.
She paused for just a moment before continuing.
Or should I say, Count and Countess Amberglass?
What?
Sophia squeaked like a girl of eight, a particularly squeaky girl of eight, much accustomed to squeaking loudly.
It's no blessing, said Doña Vorcenza. It comes with a job.
You can't be serious, said Don Lorenzo. There are 24 families on the Alcigrande with more rank and honor than ourselves. The Duke would never name us to Amberglass before them.
I believe I know Nicovante somewhat better than you do, young man, said Doña Vorcenza, and I believe the inheritance is mine to dictate.
But the job, said Doña Salvara, you can't mean...
Of course I do, Sophia. I can't live forever. Each time something like this affair lands in my lap, I suddenly recall that I don't want to live forever. Let someone else play the spider. We've deceived everyone for all these years, letting them think the office was held by a man. Now let's deceive them further by passing it on to 2 individuals.
She put her arm through Reynard's and allowed him to help her back toward the carriage.
You'll have Stephen to help you and to run your operations. He'll serve as the link between you and the Midnighters. You both have acceptably malleable wits. Given just a few more years, I'm sure I can whip the 2 of you into something resembling the shape I require.
And then? Asked Doña Sofia.
And then, my dear, all these God's damned crises will be yours to deal with.
Doña Vorcenza sighed.
Old sins will never be buried so deep that they cannot rise again when least expected. And so you'll pay for the good of Camor with the coin of your own conscience, parcelled out year after year until that purse is empty at last.
3.
Master Lamora, cried Ibelius, this is entirely unacceptable.
The sea at false light was a surging field of grey and green. The waves rolled and crashed around the galleon Golden Gain, one of only 2 vessels that had bothered to put out from Camor that evening, bound for Talisham and thence to Tal Verar. The wind wailed in the shrouds and sails of the elderly vessel, and sailors in oilcloaks hurried here and there on the decks, muttering private prayers to Yono, Lord of the Grasping Waters. Loch Lamora lay on a pile of tarp-covered crates on the galleon's raised stern deck, bundled in blankets within oilcloths, within tarps, like a sausage roll. Nothing of him was visible but his abnormally pale and heavily bruised face, poking out of the layers around him. Jean Tannen sat at his side, bundled against the rain,
but not to the point of immobility. "Master Ibelius," said Locke in a weak voice, made nasal by his broken nose, "each time I have left Camor, I have done it by land. This is something new. I wanted to see it one last time."
"You are very near death, Master Lamora," said Ibelius. "It is foolish for you to be larking about on deck in this weather."
"Ibelius," said Jean, "if what Locke is doing were larking about, corpses could get jobs as acrobats. Can we have a moment's peace?"
"From the attentions that have sustained his life this past day, by all means, young masters, enjoy your sea view, and on your heads be it."
Ibelius stomped off across the rolling deck, sliding in this direction and that, quite unaccustomed to life at sea. Camor was diminishing behind them, fading gradually between shifting curtains of rain. False light rose up from the lower city like an aura above the waves. The five towers shone ghostly beneath the churning skies. The wake of the galleon seemed to gleam with phosphorescence, a roiling false light of its own. They sat on the stern deck and watched the dark horizon swallow the city behind them.
"I'm sorry, Locke," said Jean. "I'm sorry I couldn't be more useful to you at the end."
"What the hell are you talking about? You killed Sherin and Raiza. I could never have done that. You pulled me out of the floating grave. You hauled me back to Ibelius and got another lovely fucking poultice smeared all over me. What do you have to apologize for, besides the poultice?"
"I'm a liability," he said. "My name. I've been using my real name all my life, and I never thought it had come to anything bad."
"What, the bondsmage? Oh, God, Jean. Take a false name wherever we end up. Tavern Callus is good. Let the bastard pop up all over the place. The Order of Azaguia will have a surfeit of miracles to cherish."
"I tried to kill you, Locke. I'm sorry. I couldn't do anything about it."
"You didn't try to kill me, Jean. The Falconer did. You couldn't do anything about it. Gods, I'm the one with his arm slashed open and his shoulder punched in, and you're over there moping. Enough!"
Thunder rumbled in the clouds overhead, and there was the sound of shouted orders from the forward deck of the ship.
"Jean," said Locke, "you are a greater friend than I ever could have imagined before I met you. I owe you my life too many times over to count. I would rather be dead myself than lose you, not just because you're all I have left."
Jean said nothing for several minutes. They stared north across the iron sea as the whitecaps lashed one another with an increasing tempo.
"Sorry," said Jean. "Mouth sort of ran away with me."
"Thanks, Locke."
"Well, cheer up. At least you've got more mobility than a fucking tadpole on dry land. Look at my little oilcloth castle."
Locke sighed.
"So this is winning," he said.
"It is," replied Jean.
"It can go fuck itself," said Locke.
They passed another few minutes in silence and rain.
"Locke," said Jean at last, hesitantly.
"Yes?"
"If you don't mind my asking, what is your real name?"
"Oh, gods," Locke smiled weakly. "Can't I have any secrets?"
"You know mine."
"Yeah, but you've only got the one anyway."
"Not a fair point."
"Oh, fine," said Locke. "Get over here."
Jean stumbled over to the pile of crates on which Locke was lying, and bent down to put his ear near Locke's mouth. Locke whispered five syllables, and Jean's eyes widened.
"You know," he said, "I'd have gone with Locke in preference to that myself."
"Tell me about it."
The galleon rode south before the winds of the storm, and the last few glimmers of false light faded behind them. The lights drew down into the darkness, and then they were gone for good, and the rain swept in like a wall above the surface of the sea. This concludes The Lies of Locke Lamora.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.